from 90.9 WBUR, I'm Deborah Becker. This is Radio Boston. Coming up, the latest on conditions in the Merrimack Valley, which was rocked by gas explosions and fires 6 weeks ago today.
People are coming in and breaking down in tears, and they're telling us about elderly parents, people with chronic health conditions, disabled children, and a complete inability to meet their basic needs.
Also, the candidates for Suffolk County District Attorney. We'll hear from Democrat Rachel Rollins.
Being compassionate is actually smart on crime sometimes. If we just pause for a minute and see what this person needs.
And we'll hear from her opponent, independent candidate Michael Maloney.
To pretend that police are on one side and the district attorney's office is on the other, and, you know, that's not the way the system works.
That's all coming up next on Radio Boston.
Thanks for listening to the Radio Boston podcast. If you'd like to support WBUR, go to radioboston.org and click the pledge button in the upper right-hand corner. Okay, back to the show.
This is Radio Boston. I'm Deborah Becker. Today marks exactly 6 weeks since a series of gas explosions and fires hit the Merrimack Valley, killing one person. Still, thousands of people are waiting for gas to be restored. Out of more than 8,400 residences and businesses that have gone without heat or hot water since the September 13th explosions, only 842 have had their service restored. And with temperatures dropping and a weekend nor'easter in the forecast, people are increasingly anxious about Columbia Gas meeting that November 19th deadline that it promised to restore all service. Lori Howe is Operations Director at Family Services of the Merrimack Valley, and she says many people have urgent needs.
There was a woman who came in who had an infant who was premature, had a heart condition, and was in very frail health, and simply could not go back to a cold house anymore, but did not have the resources to stay in a hotel or to get warm food or any of the things that she would need to take care of her baby.
Boston Globe reporter Milton Valencia has been following this story, and he's on the line now. Milton, thanks for being with us.
Thanks for having me.
You're actually in the Globe studio, we should say. You're not on the line. But first of all, you've been following this. You've been up in the Lawrence area. Tell us what it looks like up there.
It very much is what the mayor of Lawrence, Mayor Dan Rivera, has called a disaster zone. This isn't just about having gas, a gas stove. It's very much the construction work that's going on. There are dozens of projects happening at any given time. Roads are blocked. People can't navigate. There are detours all around. And just imagine trailers. You mentioned alternative housing that's set up. Imagine a bunch of trailers set up on what would be our Boston Common. Really, it's what the mayor's called a disaster recovery effort. And it's not about having gas or not having gas. It's all these side effects that are coming with it.
Right. So now state officials, lots of people are questioning whether this November 19th deadline that Columbia Gas set to restore service can actually be met. What do you think is happening now? Is that, based on what you're seeing, does it seem unlikely that that's going to happen, that Columbia Gas is going to be able to meet that deadline to restore service? And what's the big delay, do you think?
It seems very unlikely, to be clear. And the delay is something that even the mayor of Lawrence has said was somewhat unexpected. I think Joe Albanese, he's the person who was tapped by Columbia Gas to lead that restoration effort. Mm-hmm. He came in with an objective to replace 48 miles of pipeline. At that time, no one thought it could be done. It seems that will be done. What was unexpected is the work inside the home that people inside the homes that inspectors need to review and in some cases fix. There are homes that are out of code. There were pre-existing conditions in some of these homes. The mayor and the town managers of North Andover have demanded new appliances, making sure that everything is done safe inside the home. But as inspectors are going in, what they thought would be a half day's work of replacing a boiler and a gas stove has turned into 2 days worth of work as they're fixing infrastructure and bringing houses up to code. So it's that specific work that is taking a lot longer than they anticipated.
Right. Now, Columbia Gas did say it's going to be hosting these community meetings in Lawrence and Andover and North Andover this weekend. What do you think is the reason for that? Do you think we'll hear news from Columbia Gas in those meetings?
I think Columbia Gas is really trying to play it day by day. There's a lot lot of confidence in Joe Albanese, the person who was brought in, but there's a lot to handle here. Like I said, this isn't just about replacing pipeline and turning on a gas switch. There have been a lot of communications issues with residents, where, again, you mentioned 8,300 metered customers. That translates into thousands of residents and family members who really don't have information that they need. They're resorting to housing, alternative housing, as it gets the weather gets colder. And Maura Healey, Attorney General Maura Healey, sent representatives to meet with Columbia Gas today to demand more answers on behalf of some of those residents who, again, don't have information about when their gas will be restored, don't have information about what hotel they can stay at. Some families are staying at hotels in New Hampshire because there are no other hotels around. So I think Columbia Gas's efforts really to communicate residents have been an issue since day one, and I think they're really hosting these meetings to say, look, we're trying to get this all together, and this is what we know at this time. There is confidence now in what's being and what's being done. Confidence by the mayor, by the town managers. They tell me that they rest assured, but it's been a while to get there.
Confidence from confidence in Columbia Gas.
Confidence in Columbia Gas, not only in the restoration effort, but in that communication with residents. Again, residents don't know when their gas is being turned on. They don't know where they can stay. So I think that there's a lot of unanswered questions on all ends, and I think that's part of the reason for these community meetings this weekend.
Now, the state has also set up some emergency loan assistance for businesses in particular. What's happening there? What's happening with the businesses?
So there are a lot of businesses that are also affected, and this is, you know, a ripple effect. If one business is closed, another business is affected as well. So what has happened is Columbia Gas has set up a claims process for some of these businesses to seek long-term losses, but there are immediate, you know, damages and immediate needs of some of these businesses. So several banks have stepped forward for a no-interest loan, short-term no-interest loan, where they can seek, you know, ways to kind of mitigate some of these problems that they're having with these quick loans to address so that they can process this and help rebound and help survive, really, while they're waiting for their claims to go through Columbia Gas.
Okay.
We're talking millions of dollars here, millions
right,
of losses.
Right. So you say it looks like not November 19th. I mean, any idea, or is anyone who would be able to make such a prediction? Have you spoken with anyone who would be able to say it's probably more like beginning of December or end of the year or anything like that, Milton?
There were three ways to look at it, and no one here's the difficult thing is no one thought that the gas pipeline would be restored by November 19th, and now it looks like that will be. The bigger question is how many plumbers and how many technicians can they pull in to do this real manpower effort that's needed to go into these individual homes.
Right.
As of right now, if they're going at the rate they're going right now, we're talking several more months. But Columbia Gas is looking to ramp up that manpower as more houses become cleared, that manpower is being redirected. So it's tough to say, but judging by the work that's being needed to fix these code issues that was unanticipated, November 19th is not likely in my view, but hopefully as the weather, cold weather arrives, it won't be that much longer.
All right. Boston Globe reporter Milton Valencia, thanks so much for being with us.
Thanks for having me.
We want to turn now to someone who has had an up-close look at how these explosions are continuing to affect families in the Merrimack Valley. Linda Harvey is the chair of a group called Debbie's Treasure Chest. It provides clothing, toys, and toiletries to at-risk families. Linda, thanks so much for being with us.
Oh, thank you for having me.
So tell us, I understand Debbie's Treasure Chest, your group, was helping families immediately after these explosions. Can you tell us what you've done so far and what it looks like now?
Sure. So right after the explosion, our landlord, Marianne Nadell, who owns the Everett Mills, gave us 20,000 square feet to set up. To sort the clothing and the donations and the toiletries that we had. And seven of us from Debbie's Treasure Chest just put it together in about 3 hours. And the senior center in Lawrence has just been on the front lines. People started the senior center, and then they were sent over to us. So I would say within the first 11 days of the incident that we gave out, and this is only the ones we kept track of, probably over 3,000 bags of clothing and toiletries and blankets to folks, and we had over 350 volunteers. There are less people coming in now. But the need is very, very great. I mean, it's cold.
Right.
It's really cold.
Right. Is there any family that stands out in your mind?
There are so many families. I think for me, the families that really stand out are the ones that came in for donations and came back to volunteer because they were so grateful. One particular story sticks in my mind. It was a young family. It was a mother. A baby was about a week old. She was with her mother, so the grandmother was there and her 9-year-old child, and they came in the day after the incident, and all they wanted was a blanket because they felt it was a little too cold at the shelter. They were staying at one of the school shelters. So when they came in, we made sure that they got a lot more clothing and diapers and some snacks, and we had some young children also volunteering, and they went up to the little 9-year-old and said, "Why don't you come get some toys?" And she said, no, I don't need toys. Let somebody else get them. Hmm. So they convinced her to take the toys to bring back to the shelter to play with other kids. And that family came back the next day, and we thought that they were there just to get more things because they took so little. But they all came back to volunteer. So this is the kind of community Lawrence is.
Right. Pay it forward, right?
It is. Yeah. Pay it forward. It just people from all over. I mean, we had over 350 volunteers. We had mothers with babies attached to them. We had 5-year-olds sorting clothes. Mm-hmm. It was just unbelievable.
So when you hear like this November 19th deadline, maybe the pipeline will be back, as we just heard from Milton Valencia from the Boston Globe. Maybe we'll have the pipeline in at that time. But, you know, it might take months to try to make sure that all the necessary repairs are done so things start to at least seem normal. How do you think people will fare with that, Linda?
I don't think they'll do well. I mean, the holidays are coming. It's a hard time for so many people. So I think it's going to be very difficult. A lot of kids are really cold. A lot of parents are using resources for things that they wouldn't normally use resources for, so they don't have certain things. I know we're doing a huge coat drive that we usually don't do till November, but we're doing it now just so we can get children and adults with coats. A lot of these kids get so nervous when they're being evacuated from schools because there's a smell of gas. Mm. You know, these kids, they've left their homes. Who wants to live in a hotel room? It's not fun after the first couple of nights.
Right.
And they're living 30 miles away, some of them, in Manchester. Yeah. I mean, you want to be home and get outside and play with your friends. And the disruption is just unbelievable. So I don't know. I know Lawrence will survive because it's that type of community, and the mayor is doing just a magnificent job, but he can only do so much. There's just so many after effects. I heard yesterday of a friend, they were digging the hole near her house to fix the gas, and the hole was too big, so her entire basement was flooded.
Oh, my gosh.
So who fixed that? Who fixes that? We just don't know.
Lots of consequences from this. It's not just about the gas. Well, Linda Harvey, chair of Debbie's Treasure Chest, a charity that's been giving supplies to families in the Merrimack Valley. Linda, thanks for what you do, and thanks for joining us today.
Oh, thank you so much. Again, keep it up.
Okay.
Bye-bye.
Bye now. And as we mentioned, Columbia Gas is processing about 21,000 claims from these explosions, and many of those claims are from local businesses. Among those local businesses is Carlene's Coffee Shop in Lawrence, which remains closed even now, 6 weeks later. Earlier today, we talked with Carlene's owner, John Farrington, about how he's been coping and about what it was like for him on September 13th.
Right in front of my restaurant is where the gas came up through the street.
So what's it been like in these weeks since it happened?
It's been a roller coaster. I came down the next morning at 3 a.m., snuck in through one of the back roads, and it was surreal. I mean, it was hundreds of fire trucks, hundreds of gas workers, police, all walking house to house. And from then, it went on to the realization that I had to throw away $8,000 to $10,000 of the food then to realize it wasn't just a couple of day thing. It was going to be a month and a half. So it's been just, you know, a slow motion wreck.
Can you describe your business, Carlene's Coffee Shop, and how long you've been in business?
Yeah, it's a family business. I bought it off my parents 20 years ago, started 35 years ago, and just a nice little breakfast lunch diner.
How many people do you employ?
18 full-time and part-time.
So you've been closed ever since September 13th?
Yes.
What about your employees? What have they been doing?
Actually, you'd think they'd enjoy themselves. They're just as anxious as I am. They've filed with Columbia Gas to get paid through them. Columbia Gas made that offer about a week or two into it. But one of the my problems with that is Columbia Gas then turned around to have headhunters call them to find them employment elsewhere.
You mean so they wouldn't have to pay them?
Exactly. So I don't know how many, you know, took up that offer of finding employment elsewhere. I'll find out in a couple of days. We're going to sit down and have a meeting.
Have you filed claims with Columbia Gas?
I have. I opened the claim up. They have forwarded me about $10,000 to help with some of the business bills and stuff.
Okay, so how much has this cost you, do you think?
I don't know. I know I have absolute zip in my bank account right now. I have nothing. I had $30,000 in there, but that's the normal operating budget.
What would you have brought in these 6 weeks that you think you might have lost?
Probably around $80,000 to $100,000. A lot of that's fantasy money. I only get to keep a fraction of that.
Are you confident that Columbia Gas will be able to help you, or just confident in general, I guess, that you'll be able to get things back to normal?
My biggest fear is Columbia Gas is just, they've gone through several companies trying to manage this. The last company just came on a couple of days ago. They went from replacing all the restaurant equipment to now repairing restaurant equipment. So I'm still waiting on to see exactly how they're going to handle my equipment here. The next step is to open up and get people coming back. I'm in Lawrence. I'm in, you know, a great, great old mill city, but it's a depressed city. I claw and scratch 80% of my business in from Andover and North Andover. And they come in and, you know, they love the place and everything else. But my fear is they've moved on. They've moved on to other places. Their habits have changed. And I've lost a business that built up for 20 years.
Well, John Farrington, owner of Carlene's Coffee Shop in Lawrence, best of luck to you, and I hope that it can work out for you at some point. Thanks for telling us about what's going on for you.
Thank you.
I do want to say we did reach out to Columbia Gas for a response to John Farrington's allegation that the company had headhunters contacting his employees, but we have not received a response from Columbia Gas. And there was some good news today for a mainstay in South Lawrence, St. Patrick's Catholic Church. Father Paul O'Brien tells us that gas service to the main church itself was fully restored just in the past 24 hours, but he says this is mixed news.
We had both the gas restored a few days ago and then the work that needed to be done inside the church completed. So quite amazingly, on a pretty cold morning, we actually had a heated church. It's a great blessing.
Right. But you still have other big buildings that do not have gas.
We do. We have a large meal center from which we serve 250,000 meals a year. It still doesn't have gas, but it was converted to propane by Columbia Gas a few weeks ago. So we've actually been able to, thank God, serve hot meals, breakfast and dinner every day through the Coruna Meal Center. Excuse me. We have a large, about 30-plus room office and rectory building that has no gas, and we have a huge parish center that includes a big basketball court and other meeting spaces that also is without gas. Mm. So in the immediate aftermath of the explosions, we actually continued to serve meals without gas. So we put together bag meals for breakfast and dinner, and were able to distribute them from the meal center. We weren't able to host meals in the dining room. About 10 days after the explosions, Columbia Gas successfully converted the entire building to propane.
Mm-hmm. And how many would you say that you've been serving since you were able to do it with propane?
It's hundreds of people every breakfast and every dinner. So we have a lot of new faces, people who presumably would not need our services if they did have guest service. Well, it's also interesting to see that there are plenty of regular guests who are not around because they either have gotten temporary housing without transportation or because they've just moved elsewhere for the duration until hopefully the gas comes back.
Hmm. Now, you're in a neighborhood that was really hit by these explosions.
Yes, we're the epicenter. My parish encompasses South Lawrence, which is the half of Lawrence that lost the gas.
Mm-hmm. And so what's the neighborhood look like right now?
The neighborhood looks a little bit like regular life, but it really does look like a disaster area. Every single street has been ripped up. There are excavators and gas crews and pavers around any corner at any given day at this point. So it really does look like a unique natural disaster. In this case, it was an industrial disaster took place. Not so much the joke is that you need to get somewhere and you just point your car in that direction and one street after another is blocked off. You have no idea how you'll get from here to mm-hmm. there, but you just drive until you get there. We have no idea when this is going to come back on. Mm-hmm. We're given ballparks, but it's very hard to know.
So what do you think of this date of November 19th that Columbia Gas has said? Do you think?
Everybody is hoping that date will pan out. I don't think anyone is expecting that it will. And the news this week is that Columbia Gas and other officials are suggesting this may not be as quick as they hoped it would be. Mm-hmm. And again, it's understandable. Everyone knows that most of our buildings have structural issues and have code issues. So we're not talking about Beverly Hills. This is an old city with old buildings, and a lot of them are not in good condition. No one, I think, is shaking their fists at reality and saying, how can this be? But it's just very, very difficult to try to be raising kids, particularly if you're a single mom, to have no good idea when you're going to be able to have hot water again, have heat again. So even if you've moved into temporary housing, which something like 7,000 people have, it's an anxiety-ridden time.
Father Paul O'Brien, pastor of St. Patrick Church in Lawrence, thanks so much for joining us.
You're welcome.
Stay with us. Coming up, we'll hear from both candidates running for Suffolk County District Attorney. I'm Deborah Becker, and this is Radio Boston. Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Deborah Becker. For the first time in more than 15 years, Suffolk County voters will choose a new district attorney this election because longtime DA Dan Conley has stepped down. The choice in next month's election is between Democrat Rachel Rollins and independent candidate Michael Maloney. We will talk with Rachel Rollins in just a few minutes, but first we're joined in studio by Michael Maloney. Welcome to Radio Boston.
Deborah, good afternoon. Thank you very much for the opportunity.
Well, thanks for coming in. You and your opponent are considered fairly progressive in terms of district attorney candidates. What do you think are the big differences?
Well, you're right. We certainly are running on progressive platforms. Me, myself, I've been practicing criminal law as a defense attorney for a decade now. Some of the big differences, though, again, I'm not going to leave my experience as a defense attorney behind. I certainly value treatment over incarceration, mm-hmm. Truly, for nonviolent addicts. But some places that we truly differentiate, I take a very hard line on gun violence. I support minimum mandatories for gun charges. There have been way too many violent crimes. Homicides are up. Going big picture here, Deborah, in regards to the method and the mechanisms by which my opponents and I are looking to incorporate reform, that's really the big differentiating variable here. I'm talking about progressive reform, not necessarily issuing blanket statements saying we're not going to prosecute, but alternatively looking at incorporating reform based on a revised cash bail system, adjustments in regards to minimum mandatories associated with addicts, and working with law enforcement, not necessarily against law enforcement, to ensure the safety of the public at large.
So I think in some regards, you're referring to a list that was published by Rachel Rollins, this sort of do not prosecute list of 15 crimes that she said that she wouldn't prosecute. I want to play a little bit of tape here from her and have you react to it, because I think this sort of explains a little bit more here about what's going on. And she said that the reason that she came up with this list of crimes that she wouldn't prosecute for things like drug possession and resisting arrest is because she thinks the resources should go elsewhere. Let's listen.
We have a 67% recidivism rate, guys, for some of these crimes. And what I'm doing is proposing a potential solution where we just do a quality control check on these 15 and see pre-arraignment whether these individuals need diversion, whether they need treatment instead of incarceration. And why I did this, the most important thing of all of this, I want to focus our attention on violent serious crimes.
So Michael Maloney, it still sounds a little similar to me in terms of what you're saying. I mean, she is saying treatment, not incarceration, but she does have this list of crimes that she doesn't want to prosecute automatically. Mm-hmm. So where is the big difference here?
The difference is not necessarily in the intentions that my opponent and I are looking to incorporate. It's really in the mechanism by which we're looking to incorporate. So, for example, rather than not prosecute, I take, you know, people need to be held accountable. If individuals are not held accountable, then unfortunately, crime is going to increase. That's inevitable. You want to talk about my path to progressive, responsible reform? Well, I'm talking about bail reform, the cash bail system. For example, no longer requesting bail on individuals, which my administration will not be seeking a jail sentence. I tell you, that sounds like a pretty common sense, but unfortunately, I can tell you as a defense attorney, I have seen hundreds and hundreds of individuals held on $100 bail where the prosecution actually never intended to seek a jail sentence. Not only is it the wrong thing to do, but, you know, financially, it is simply inefficient. Now, I do agree that responsible reform needs to be incorporated. You know, we should not be prosecuting conditions of poverty, conditions of mental health, conditions of addiction. Again, I do favor treatment, but the mechanism by which I'm incorporating varies tremendously. I can tell you another differentiating point right here. I do not support increasing the juvenile age, which is what my opponent does. That just allows an opportunity to become hardened while they're in the system. I do support, however, increasing diversionary programs from the age of 18 to 25.
Okay, so your opponent has suggested that she supports, we haven't talked with her directly yet, but that she supports increasing the age of adult criminal responsibility from the age of 18, where it is now in Massachusetts, to the age of 21. You don't support that, but instead you would say use diversion programs instead?
That is correct.
Okay.
And again, the overarching objective here, you know, I've been a defense attorney. Again, I'm not going to leave that experience. I want to keep people out of the system whenever possible. But to kick the can down the road and to arbitrarily suggest that increasing juvenile, the age where an individual is legally responsible as an adult from 18 to 21, you know, that is not going to rectify the issue. What that's going to do is take a 16, 17-year-old kid that's on the verge, the cusp of making going the right path or the wrong path, and it's going to allow them to continue being hardened because they are not held accountable.
Well, some might say put an 18-year-old in jail, and that will definitely seal that 18-year-old's fate of being hardened.
Oh, I certainly would agree. And again, I'm advocating for treatment over incarceration for nonviolent addicts. I would agree with that position.
But if someone were that age and got in trouble now, wouldn't that typically be the way it went? You know, maybe they wouldn't go to an adult jail, but they might go to a diversion program?
Well, actually, diversionary programs, I'm licensed in 4 states. I've been practicing all over this state for a very long time. I can tell you that diversionary programs in Suffolk County are now only afforded in the juvenile system. That's not the same as other counties within Massachusetts. Again, I'm not looking to reinvent the wheel across the board. I'm picking and selecting ideas and theories that have worked in other counties and in other states. And diversionary programs are one, you know, component that we can incorporate on day one, which is exactly what I'll do.
Let's move on a little bit because we're going to run out of time here. This position involves managing hundreds of employees. There's a $20 million budget in the district attorney's office. What do you think in your background qualifies you for this?
Well, thank you for the question. I appreciate it. In addition to practicing criminal law and building a very successful practice with offices both in Boston and Brockton, I have been a serial entrepreneur for probably close to 15 years. I have built, managed, and sold many companies in the Commonwealth. And I can tell you that just in December of 2017, I sold my most recent company, Canacare Docs, which was a medical marijuana evaluation facility. When I sold that company with my partner, we had employed, at that point, 182 employees over seven states. You know, I can tell you that the company has continued to grow, and I don't say that to boast whatsoever, but this position is truly a combination of having criminal law experience and managerial experience. And when you want to talk about managerial experience, I'm happy to do it all day long, but I would also respectfully request you look at legal experience. I have handled misdemeanors through life sentence felony cases across the state for a very long time. In fact, I had to take 3 weeks off from campaigning in April to manage a Superior Court felony case in Fall, not to manage, to try a Superior Court felony case in Fall River Superior. My opponent has not actually ever had a jury trial. My opponent has not actually argued motions or been in the criminal law system at the state level. And when you're talking about managerial experience, again, let's have that conversation all day long, but let's not pretend you can be in a position to manage several hundred employees, attorneys, when you've never actually practiced in this industry.
The Boston Globe earlier this month reported on a restraining order that your wife had sought against you. And in that restraining order, she said that three times between 2013 and 2014, you were intoxicated, threatening, and violent, saying that you threatened her, threatened to cut her father, put holes in the wall with a hammer. Now you have addressed this a bit, and you've said it was a low point in your life. But first, I want to make clear, do you take any issue with those things as alleged in that request for a restraining
I can say
order?
That I spoke with my former wife most recently, actually today. We have an amicable relationship. I am not proud of the decisions that I made verbally when I was going through a divorce. It was, when you say a low point, that's not accurate. It was the lowest point in my life. I was absolutely heartbroken, and I wish I could take back things I said and things I did. But, you know, my experience has been as a defense attorney that people should not be judged at the lowest point in their life. Rather, you should look at the individual as a whole. I can tell you that my former wife supports me. She has said she is publicly available to speak with the media. I speak with her, I don't want to say routinely, but we have each other's respect. We have each other's respect, and we have developed an amicable, respectful relationship. You know, again, I made mistakes in the past. I would ask people to judge me by the entirety of my person rather than an isolated incident during the lowest point of my life from 5 years ago.
So you don't think, I mean, what about voters who might say, I think this raises questions about your temperament overall?
Well, you know, again, that's a very valid question, and thank you for allowing me the opportunity to address it. But in regards to, you know, my temperament, I didn't come into this campaign having any false expectations that my past would not, you know, come to light. I've been very candid about where I've come from. I've been very candid about my background. I am an open book.
Do you think you should have been more forthcoming about this first, about this restraining order issue? Because it didn't come out really until the Globe.
You know, I certainly tried to be. I, as an independent, you're right. I mean, I should have been more proactive about addressing it. But I got to tell you, running as an independent is really difficult. I showed up to not just one, not just two, not just three, but many debates during the primary, and then was told at the door, you have to leave because you're not a registered Democrat. Again, I'm an independent. I don't have the support of either party platform. I am out there hustling day in, day out, each and every night. In hindsight, yes, I should have been more proactive and figured out a way to make it abundantly clear. I'm not hiding from my past. I'm not hiding from mistakes. I am a flawed individual. I have made mistakes. And when I was heartbroken, oh man, I wish I could take it back. But that's who I am. I'm asking voters to look at me in the entirety. Look at my positions. Look at what I've done over 10 years. Look at how I've afforded individuals. Former clients, you know, took care of their case. Represented them pro bono and then offered them employment on the flip side. I have been advocating for second chances my whole life, and, you know, I'm asking for the same in this situation.
So when you're talking about reform, it's a professional passion for you as well as one that's personally informed.
Oh, I got involved into this industry, like I said, about 10 years ago. Some of the highest points in my career have been individuals that have come back to me after I've represented them. You know, they may have started off as clients, but they've become friends. And they've reached out to me. They've asked me how I am. I have relationships with their family. Yes, it is absolutely a professional career, but I tell you, it bleeds over into the private sector constantly.
I just want to touch on one issue before we run out of time, and that's something that's been in the news this week when the state Supreme Judicial Court Chief Justice Ralph Gantz talked about these controversies that we're hearing about judges in Massachusetts and whether judges should be removed because of controversial rulings. Do we now have enough oversight of judges in Massachusetts, and should that system change? And I'm sorry that you have a minute to answer.
I tell you, that's a topic that we could spend a long time talking about.
Yeah.
There is not enough oversight of judges, and there certainly should be.
Should some be removed?
Listen, there are some judges. I can answer again. I've practiced in every county across the state, with the one exception being Nantucket. I can tell you that the way cases are dealt with varies tremendously based on the individual on the bench. Mm-hmm. You know, agree or disagree with the judge's position. It should always be respectful. It should always be respectful. The overwhelming majority of the time, that is the case. But I can tell you, I've witnessed it firsthand where that is simply not what happens. There should be more oversight.
All right. Michael Maloney, independent candidate for Suffolk County District Attorney. Thanks for coming in.
I appreciate the opportunity. Thank you.
Okay. Stay with us. Coming up, we'll hear from the Democratic candidate for Suffolk County DA, Rachel Rollins. I'm Deborah Becker. This is Radio Boston. Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Deborah Becker. Well, we just heard from the independent candidate for Suffolk County District Attorney, Michael Maloney, and now we want to turn to the Democratic candidate, Rachel Rollins. Rachel, welcome to Radio Boston.
Thank you so much for having me.
So we started by asking your opponent, what did he think makes the two of you different, since you're both on progressive platforms? What would you say?
Well, I would say that I've actually prosecuted a case. So this is a district attorney's office that that prosecutes people, quite frankly. And so I think that in order to do the job, you should have prosecuted a case. You should have presented a case to a grand jury, which is the way that in Massachusetts we bring cases in superior court. And so I have actually done the job. And then more importantly, the DA doesn't actually try cases. So this is an office of 275 employees that operates within government, which is different than the private sector. $20 million budget, 34,000 cases a year. You need to be a really good manager because Dan Conley, in the 16 years he served, did not try a case during one of those 16 years he supervised an office.
Mm-hmm. I just want to say your opponent brought up your experience in the courtroom and said that he thought that he had more experience as a criminal defense attorney because he hadn't been on that side of things. But
I actually have. I would love for you to ask me about my experience. I've been a criminal defense attorney while I was at Bingham McCutcheon and did handle cases on the criminal defense side. I've been a prosecutor. I've been a lawyer for 21 years. And so in addition, I've done civil rights matters before, and I've represented the police. So I have very good relationships with the police. I'm endorsed by a police patrolman's association, and I have actually held the police accountable before and sued the police when they were engaged in alleged discriminatory behavior. So I have a very broad range of experiences over two decades of work as a lawyer in Boston.
And so what is it about that experience and just about, your background, your temperament that you think makes you ready to take on this large leadership position in a $20 million budget?
Yeah. So I've been the head lawyer for Massport. I've been the head lawyer for the MBTA and MassDOT. That's 10,000 employees at the MBTA and MassDOT. Massport has 1,500 employees that are employed by Massport, over 18,000 employees on our footprint. Head lawyer for all three of those organizations. Being a lawyer in government is very different than practicing on your own or owning a business. You must operate within the confines of certain laws. So, for example, public records requests. Private employers don't have to comply with those type of governances that we have, ethics requirements. We have any number of record retention laws that were, if you've read articles about the state police, for example, all of these things I was the head lawyer for in multiple different state agencies and authorities. And then very candidly, I have excellent relationships with the federal government because I've been an assistant United States attorney. So many of these very large cases that the Superior Court is handling for the DA's office, they're working with my former supervisors, John Wortman, Glenn McKinley, in the U.S. Attorney's Office, because they are joint task forces that are looking at the type of cases that DA's make decisions about.
Let's talk about the list of 15, which everyone has talked with you about.
Sure.
And this is, we did address this with your opponent, Michael Maloney, and this is a list of 15 crimes, that so-called decline to prosecute list. And of course, that list includes things like shoplifting, resisting arrest, but the most controversial seems to be possession with intent to distribute charges that you might decline to prosecute. The Boston Police Patrolmen's Union, the Mass Retailers Association, both have said that they're concerned about this proposal. Mm-hmm. Tell us why you want it.
So what's wonderful is I'm proposing something. Right. I came forward with a possible solution to a problem that we have. The criminal justice system does not work for too many people. Overwhelmingly, it doesn't work for the poor. Overwhelmingly, it doesn't work for people of color. It doesn't work for the mentally ill. It doesn't work for people struggling with addiction. And I'm proposing a solution. And what I will tell you is that as a former prosecutor myself, the only person in this race that's ever prosecuted a case, we have one tool that we use in our toolbox as prosecutors: jail. The tool is incarceration. I want more tools. I want the tool of rehabilitation, diversion, civil infractions, the tool of social workers to be used. We have a 67% recidivism rate in Massachusetts. Hmm. So what we're doing now, trying to arrest our way to the solution of these petty quality of life crimes, it's not working. It costs us $50,000 to house someone in the Suffolk County House of Corrections. What I'm proposing is pre-arraignment. When these individuals come in with one of these 15, let's just pause for a moment before they get branded with a Corey, with a record, right? Mm-hmm. Let's just say, wow, you are homeless. You are struggling with a mental health issue or suspected mental health issue. Let's get you some services. Let's get you to return what it is that you might have shoplifted and get you treatment so that you don't come back into contact with our system. Right. And what I'm proud about is I've sat down with Mike O'Leary at the Boston Police Patrolmen's Association. I've met with Commissioner Gross in Boston. I've met with Chief Kyes in Chelsea. And we're starting to have great conversations. That's how change starts.
Hmm. I wonder, though, there are some folks who would say, you know, this list might remove a deterrent mm-hmm. to crime. And also, I wonder if there are some in law enforcement, some police officers, because I've heard this in other stories, that are concerned that what you're doing is also bringing a social work role to the criminal justice system, mm-hmm. that all of a sudden the criminal justice system, which has to be concerned about protecting public safety, why now do we have to worry about who needs treatment? How do we address mental health? How are we going to deal with homelessness? That's not our role, I've heard law enforcement say. So what do you say?
What I say back is, yes, it is. It's not working the way that it is. If your role is solving homicides, if your role is keeping communities safe, all of the institutions that have failed these individuals up to us, all I'm saying is I don't wanna say that's not my issue or someone else failed you. Let's send you away to jail. I'm trying to save us money. I'm trying to make a potential solution where individuals will no longer come in contact with my office. And what I love to say back when you say, well, the Patrolmen's Association and the Retail Association aren't happy, you know who's happy? President Barack Obama, who mentioned Larry Krasner in Boston, and what we're proposing is excellent things. The New Yorker, the Washington Post, the AP,
right.
Nationally, people are looking at Boston and saying, wow, you're thinking about things differently.
Well, I wonder then, you mentioned Krasner, of course, new district attorney in Pennsylvania, a reform-minded district attorney, and that's why you're mentioned. You're mentioned along with other reform people who are in the criminal justice system. But when Mr. Krasner got into office, he also did a house clearing, really, of mm-hmm. folks in that office to affect the cultural change that he wanted
sure.
as the chief prosecutor. Would that be something that you might have to do to affect change in Suffolk County if you're elected?
Well, let's make sure we're clear, and your listenership knows this. The DA in Philadelphia was indicted, right, mm-hmm. prior to District Attorney Krasner. Dan Conley served with distinction for 16 years. He left. John Pappas is now your current Suffolk County District Attorney. We're not in the same situation as Philadelphia. I will say, though, that there are many things that District Attorney Krasner in Philadelphia, Kim Fox in Cook County, Chicago, and others around the country are doing that are important. And there will be some changes in the office, but overwhelmingly I'm hearing excellent things about the lawyers in that office. I've worked with some of them on some cases as well. And so I'm not at this moment. I want to tell you, I'm focused on winning November 6th. Prior to that, I'm not talking about any sort of housekeeping matters that I would do as the DA. I have to become your DA first. And that's why we are continuing to work as hard as we did in the primary, as we are right now.
Okay. I want to ask you about something that was in the news this week. I also asked your opponent about this, and that's SJC Chief Justice Ralph Gantz talking about these calls to remove certain judges for having unpopular decisions. And Chief Gantz says that removing these judges and sort of trying to hold judges accountable for unpopular decisions could compromise the judiciary. What do you think about that? Do you think we need better oversight of the judges in the system?
I saw Chief Justice Gantz make that statement at the State of the Judiciary, I think, yesterday. Mm-hmm. I was there. You know, change is hard. And I believe what I like about our judges is they are vetted. They are put through an incredibly long process, right? So I was fortunate enough by Governor Deval Patrick to be appointed to his Judicial Nominating Commission. And, you know, I believe that I like the fact that our system is transparent. I like the fact that people can speak out and say they disagree with what this trial court judge did. People can appeal those decisions. I think there that what I'd like is more transparency about if you're unhappy with what a judge did, if you believe that a judge was acting outside of his or her authority, or was biased in some way or had engaged in behavior in that sense, that the public knows how to file those complaints. I think we do a very poor job of letting the voters and the residents of Suffolk County and the Commonwealth know what their rights are to appeal things and to voice their concerns. But I think change is hard. Mm-hmm. And I think, it's very interesting when judges make unpopular decisions, you know, and people are reading after the fact. I like the conversations that it starts as a result of that. Mm-hmm. So and then we have to pay attention, people, you know, there are public forum where you can listen in front of the governor's council, for example, when a judge is being vetted or a potential judge. The public can show up to that and ask questions or send questions into the governor's council. So we need to get involved.
Hmm. And the system for oversight could improve.
I personally think the system could improve in the way of people knowing how they can voice concerns, right? I don't think our government works right now about, I have a problem with a judge. How do I get that? Who do I get it to? How do I write it? What's the process? We need people to be told how they can voice their opinions better, I think.
And possibly remove judges.
I mean, ultimately, if there are things that are being done that are unethical, things that are being done that are unlawful, of course, right. I believe that. Yes.
Yeah. But not over, say, a decision where someone feels that someone accused of a crime shouldn't have been let out on bail.
I mean, I think there are unpopular decisions that happen with judges. And I think we need to be better at explaining the process, what the standard is, what the requirement is in order for the judge to make his or her decision. That's the education factor that I think the government isn't doing quite well.
One thing I want to make sure that I get you to address, because your opponent brought it up, and we only have about a minute or so left here, but that is why you think it's a good idea to raise the minimum age of adult criminal responsibility to 21.
Yeah, I mean, I overall just think if we can get people more services and help, overwhelmingly, it's a better situation, right? I don't believe in the broken windows theory of crime, and my opponent does, and has said that many, many times, depending on where he is. I believe in giving people an opportunity to get better, and what I want to make sure you understand, this list of 15, why I did it is I want to divert my resources to violent crimes, right? I've prosecuted people. I've made decisions where they've gone away. And we have had 8 homicides in a 2-week period. That's what I want my money on. Mm-hmm. We have a 15% solve rate on non-fatal shootings. That's not anything to be proud of. We need to focus resources on that. So I am smart on crime. I want our money with limited resources focused on violent, serious crimes. That's why I came up with this proposed solution. And I'm excited about the fact that it started really important conversations about wealth disparities, race disparities, mental illness, addiction, and poverty, and how we criminalize that.
All right. Rachel Rollins, Democratic nominee for Suffolk County District Attorney. Thanks so much for coming in today.
Thanks for having me. Take care.
That's our show for today. Radio Boston is a production of 90.9 WBUR, Boston's NPR news station. Our show is produced by Jamie Bologna, Chris Sitterick, Paris Alston, and Zoe Mitchell. We had help today from Eve Zuckoff. Tim Skog is our technical director. Our executive producer is Hitesh Hati. I'm Deborah Becker. Join us again tomorrow for more Radio Boston.